No dairy, no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, beardos? Welcome to episode 50 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes on the Commentist Network at thecommentist.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will find out where we've been and what we've been eating, and then dive into the mailbag, where we will answer listener questions, comments, and concerns as submitted by all you beautiful beardos via email, as well as comments on our Instagram and at thecommentist.com. Whew, that was a mouthful.
Great intro, Paul.
Thank you.
I like the way you said, in today's episode.
So, Andy, what have we been eating?
Paul.
Yes?
We went down and did our first ever live podcast.
We did.
As people know, because that was last week's episode. And I think it's safe to say we both had a lot of fun.
We did. Yes, it was. There was about five people there, which is five. I keep telling everyone we had five people there, which is five more than I expected to be there. None of them, as I don't believe any of them had ever listened to our podcast before, but everyone was very polite. Everyone was very receptive. They asked questions at the end, which was awesome. I didn't expect people to be that engaged. There was one person that wasn't even vegan, and it's like it's really awesome that she, you know, listened to what we had to say, because I can't imagine that, because our podcast is definitely geared more towards, I would say, people that are already vegan. So it's really cool that she came out and listened to us.
Yeah, and she was the first person to ask a question as well. So
yes,
so we are both looking forward to doing more in the future. If you are listening and you host an event of some kind, go ahead and invite us on down. Maybe it'll work out. But after we did this, we were both on an adrenaline kick and very excited, and we decided to go celebrate at Blackbird Pizza.
Which is definitely in my top, I would say my top three vegan restaurants, vegan eating establishments.
Wow. Paul, that's high praise from you.
I love it. I love it so much.
I know you love pizza.
I do love pizza. So I got a slice of spicy barbecue pizza, delicious. Got a slice of mushroom pizza, delicious. And then, of course, I got my deep-fried vegan bullshit, the root beer barbecue wings, which Andy allegedly not a huge fan of.
I'm not a big seitan fan.
I guess it's more than allegedly because I was there and you said, I'm not a huge fan of this.
Cite your sources, Paul. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just don't love big hunks of fried seitan. I would much rather something that actually has a better texture.
And actually, because the last time I went to Blackbird Pizza, probably about a year or so ago, they were like smaller chunks for the wings. And now it was just like five massive chunks of seitan. Like they looked very, very wingy. Like they were about the size of what you would expect a normal barbecued wing to be. So it was delicious though. They were huge. They were messy. Used a lot of napkins, but it was great.
I do take issue with the barbecue root beer barbecue sauce. I don't think it really tastes anything like root beer.
Yeah.
It's just like a little extra sweet, maybe.
It's delicious.
Well, I had a slice of pepperoni pizza, and I think they must be using some kind of homemade pepperoni because it's these really large pepperoni circles, and that was really good, but the star of the meal was the cheesesteak that I got.
We need a compilation of you saying the star of the meal.
I think it starts with the last episode. This cheesesteak, and the cheesesteak is just mostly a bunch of like shaved seitan, but they grill it up and it's crispy and juicy, and they marinate it in something, I'm assuming. And it has peppers and onions and their cheese, and it's on really good bread. And the bread's kind of a crucial element of the cheesesteak. So I think Blackbird might have my favorite cheesesteak of any place I've been to.
Hmm. I told Andy, I'm not, like, cheesesteak isn't, it's good. I like cheesesteak, but it's just never been something that has super, super duper wowed me. So if there's cheesesteak on a menu, I'll usually order something else, but I'll have to take your word for it, Andy.
It's, well, you tried a little bit of the filling. You thought it was good,
right? It was good. Yeah, it's good. I just, like, am not blown away by it.
See, I am the opposite, where if cheesesteak's on a menu, I'm usually going to gravitate towards that as my first choice.
Interesting.
It's you got grilled onions and peppers and cheesy, meaty goodness. It's great, Paul. All right, that's enough food talk. Let's switch it over to the mailbag, Paul, because I think we have one hefty whopper of an episode ahead of us.
One hefty vegan whopper.
One hefty vegan whopper. Paul, before we get into any listener questions, I wanted to say this. We hit episode 50.
Yay.
I feel pretty good about that.
Me too.
I wanted to ask you if you had any favorite moments of the podcast over the last 50 years. I mean, 50 episodes.
Wait, did you not say that on purpose?
I did not.
You know, it's funny because it's like, I feel like my favorite episodes keep being the ones that are most recent. Like, I feel like even though I think we've settled into a nice routine, I think we got a pretty good flow with each other. We act like we like each other on the microphone, and that works out pretty well. But
to be clear, we do travel in separate tour buses.
And I live in a house and I make Andy live in the van outside. But
he won't let me shower, but he says you can go jump in the creek out back if you want to wash up.
But I don't know. I like our movie review episodes. I think those are pretty fun because we can just kind of, you know, tear something apart for the most part. No, that's not why I like it. But
some people just want to watch the world burn, Paul.
Yeah, that's what it ends up turning into. But I like that. I like those. I like doing those sorts of critiques. I don't know. I wasn't prepared for this. Andy just asked me this on the spot. I guess if I had read the notes over closer, I would have seen that. But you go first.
I made the little question about this as cryptic as possible so Paul wouldn't actually know what it was in case he did read over the show notes. I agree with you. I think our movie review episodes are always my most favorite. And I think that if we can do a little plug for next week's episode, it's already recorded before this one even was. And I think it's a very silly episode. We had a lot of fun with it. So I hope people enjoy that one.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna pull back the curtain and let people know that the next episode is already recorded. But yes, the next episode, that's definitely the one that's on my mind, especially since we recorded it, what, two nights ago? So that episode was very fun to record. So right now, that's all I can think of and being like, wow, that was a really good one to record. But I definitely do like talking about some of the more intense topics. I like having the guests on. I think probably one of my favorites is the nonviolent communication one, because I think I've taken a lot of the things that we talked about that episode and just kind of incorporated them into my everyday life, in my veganism and just in general. So I think that one personally was probably the most beneficial for me, even though they're all, you know, for the most part, fun to do. What about you, Andy?
I thought you'd never ask, Paul. I was thinking about some of my favorite interviews. And with this show, I typically don't go back and listen once we've released it. But there are a few interviews that I find myself going back and listening to over and over again, just because I really like listening to the guest talk. And definitely the Ramon Ganesan nonviolent communication interview. That would be one of my favorites. And I think my other favorite that I always go back to is the one with Doomy Bay all the way back. I think that was like episode 10. He's just a delightful person to talk to and has such a great story and a really interesting outlook on life and activism. And those would probably be my highlights as far as interviews go.
Nice. Nice.
All right. So with that said, let's dig deep into this mailbag, Paul.
Mail time.
Strap on your headband. Get ready to sweat.
Already there, Andy. It's very hot in here.
All right. Let me ask you this first question, Paul.
All right.
This is actually something that we have not talked about in quite a while, so we will see how we feel about this. We got an email from Jennifer, and Jennifer actually wrote us a couple of questions. I've tried to order these in easiest to hardest order, or most softball to most hardball. Whatever it is. So we're putting this in first. We'll talk about the rest of Jennifer's email later. Question number one, why don't you accept donations for your podcast efforts? The worker is worth his wage. I'm sure you have spent money on better equipment. Plus, there is your time and effort. I would donate. So Thank you for that, Jennifer.
Yeah, thank you.
Paul, how do you feel about this?
There was a point pretty early on when we were debating about whether to put up what's called a Patreon account, which is a website where you can kind of donate to you would be able to donate to the podcast, and then in exchange for your donations, we would have like extra content or something like that. Or you could just straight up donate. But I think ultimately we decided against it, and we just decided against in general trying to get actual sponsorship, like something like Audible, which if you listen to other podcasts, they are probably sponsored by Audible.
or Stamps.com or Casper Mattress.
Yeah, yeah. Or LegalZoom. but ultimately, we kind of decided against it. You know, we just wanted it to be a nice sponsor-free show. I don't know. We decided that, like I said, pretty early on, and I haven't really thought about it since. In terms of like equipment and stuff, I know Andy has bought some microphones. He's gone through a few microphones because his always break. In the past few episodes, you may have noticed that there's been this crackling noise occasionally, which I'm pretty sure is my computer pooping out. So maybe I'll need to get a new computer sometime soon. But so it's like all this stuff is kind of out of our pockets, which, you know, it's a little bit, but it's not, we're not buying like professional recording equipment, even though it may sound professional because of the fine editing work by Mr. Andy. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess at this point we've just done it for so long that it's not really something that I think about.
Yeah, I think early on we were discussing the possibility of sponsors and all that stuff. And both of us, this is, you know, we're not trying to make this our like our main form of income. It is something that we both love to do and have a lot of fun with. But I think it's mostly something that we do for fun. You know, with that said, it is a mountain of work. It is a ton of work. And I don't think either of us would be opposed to getting compensated for that. But as far as like sponsors and stuff go, just like the effort that it takes to put into getting those and procuring them and asking for that, it's not really something that I'm personally interested in. And I know Paul certainly doesn't even have the time to do that. So
no, I do not.
Yeah, so I think that we're just kind of like, we don't need money to make this work, so we're just fine. I think both of us also just kind of come from this background of, you know, punk and hardcore and things like that, where it's just like, you know, I spent a very long time touring in a band and never made any money off of it and never expected to or really even wanted to. So I guess that's just kind of something that's like ingrained into my head. But
yeah, yeah, definitely.
I know we both definitely want to have t-shirts. And if you've checked out the Instagram, you probably saw one mock-up on there. And mostly that's just a matter of scrapping together the money and getting the time to actually make that happen. And when something like that happens where we actually have a physical good to provide to someone for money, I think that is something that we will definitely make available at some point. And I don't know, who knows, maybe we'll set up like a PayPal if someone like really wants to donate, but it's not, we're not hurting for it. So we figure why muddy up the podcast with asking for money or having donations if we don't really need it.
Well put, Andy. So question number two comes from Catherine Reuter. Sorry if I mispronounce your name, from Instagram, and that was vegan book recommendations, not necessarily limited to cookbooks, but those are great too. So I'm gonna let Andy do this one, because I do like reading, but I have no time to read. So I really, unfortunately, it's a shame, but I barely read, and when I do read, it's usually some nerdy sci-fi fantasy stuff. So I cannot say I have any good vegan book recommendations, but I know Andy does.
I got a couple. I am also like Paul in that I am a busy person.
He's a busy boy.
I'm a busy bee. And I'm like a person that's always working on like five books at once and like reading a chapter from each one like every 2 months, like just very slowly, snail's pace kind of going through. With that said, some things that I'm either in the middle of now or have read recently or have had an impact on me, I wanted to give a plug for A Vegan Ethic, which is by Mark Hawthorne, and he is a friend of the show, a listener of the show, and I am not through with that one, but I find it fascinating thus far. And he also wrote a book called Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism, which I read a long time ago, and I found that to be immensely helpful in figuring out how, you know, I wanted to engage in activism to sort of increase my impact for animals out there. Another one that I've been like slowly working my way through, it's kind of, I don't want to say academic, but there's something about it that doesn't flow easily for me, even though I find it fascinating. And that is a book called Aftershock, Confronting Trauma in a Violent World. And that's by Patrice Jones. And it's essentially a book about self-care for yourself, or if you are someone who is a friend or partner or family member of an activist that has experienced trauma. And trauma can be defined in so many different ways, as the book kind of outlines. That is a book that I think a lot of people would gain a lot from, especially listeners of the show that are engaging in activism out there. So that's Aftershock. And then the last vegan book I'll talk about is called The Vegan Sourcebook by Joanne Stepaniak. And that's actually like the first like vegan book I read when I went vegan. I'd been vegan for a little bit and I bought this, and it was like the first like comprehensive, this is what veganism's about. Here's food stuff. Here's the deal with hunting. Here's the deal with zoos. And it was like a thing that I just like couldn't put down. I just found it so fascinating. So I used to like read like every vegan book that could come out because I wanted to know what to recommend and wanted to be informed. And now I'm kind of at a place where I don't feel as compelled to do that. But that book was one that just like couldn't put it down. And then as far as cookbooks, two plugs. I just want to say Vegan Bowl Attack from Jackie Soban. Jackie does a lot of the photography for like Veg News. So this book is just absolutely stunning, beautiful photography and simple like bowl type meals that you can put together. So that's a really good one. And then also Eat Like You Give a Damn, which was done by Michelle and Josh from Herbivore Clothing. That's a really cool book because it has the recipes, but also kind of just talks about vegan ethics a little bit as well. So if you're looking for new cookbooks, those ones are both out fairly recently within the last year.
You know what, Andy?
I know a cookbook that you got, Paul.
I did. That's what I was going to say. You already knew what I was going to say.
Plug it.
I got the Satanic Spellbook, spelled like Satan. So I guess it's the Satanic Spellbook by the vegan black metal chef. And so I'm not someone that's good at cooking, and I'm not someone that like will like to look at a cookbook and like follow the steps and blah, 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 blah. But how this one is written is it's kind of like his attitude is like, you find out what's good for you and you do that. So it almost gives you more of outlines of dishes, and then you kind of figure out what works for you. So it's just written like, if you've ever seen his videos or something, it's written like with this attitude that's just like, I don't really care about things. And it's very funny. Like it'll say things like, peel the potatoes or don't. I don't give a shit. And it's like that kind of stuff. And I'm like, so I find myself giggling when I'm reading it. I would recommend that one.
And we interviewed the vegan black metal chef on the podcast way back in the day, like episode 3 or 4, yeah, 5, somewhere around there. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I like his style of cooking a lot because he's like, when I've seen him do cooking demos and he's just like, all right, we're going to make rice. I assume you know how to use a rice cooker, so that's already made. And just like, you know, and just like, yeah, he's like, use whatever spices you have. Like, you know what you like. You can figure out the quantities. And not in a way that's like dismissive, but just in a way that like actually trusts the cookbook reader to like be able to rely on their own sense of taste to know what's going to be like best for them. And it's a lot of very accessible, simple ingredients that you can find at any grocery store. He's very cost conscious as well. So that's Book Corner with the Bearded Vegans. Paul, you got a lot of questions. So
yay.
This is the first one. This is coming from Rose, who is That Vegan Cosplayer on Instagram. This may be easier for Paul. Do you ever feel part of two worlds? As a nerd and a vegan, I don't feel like I quite fit into either group. As a nerd, I feel tons of bacon culture. As a nerd, I see tons of bacon culture, and as a vegan, most vegans I meet tend to be punk or in the music scene. Nerd references go unnoticed in the vegan community, and animal rights talk in the nerd community gets dissed. How do you deal with that? That's definitely for Paul, although Paul is a punk and part of the music scene.
Yeah.
but I feel like I'm kind of a nerdy guy, but certainly not on the level that Rose is talking about here. And I definitely more identify with like the punk and hardcore kind of identity. So Paul, how do you feel about this?
So it's interesting because she did bring up like the fact that most vegans she tends to meet tend to be in the punk or the music scene, which definitely applies to me. Like, I would consider myself in the punk and music scene. And it's interesting because, like, the punk veganism, I feel like, is much more closely tied with the punk and music scene, definitely, than it is with the nerd scene. So it's, that's kind of nice that you can go to, like, you can go to a show, like a punk show, and you know that there are going to be people there that are, that probably have very similar viewpoints as you. And it's like, I do, like, I totally wish that that was in the nerd scene as well. And I feel like I've almost kind of like accepted that I'm not going to be able to find as many vegans in the nerd scene. Like, whenever I go to an event, like Kineticon, or when I went to Gen Con, that was in Indianapolis, it's like, I was wearing like my vegan t-shirts and stuff kind of in the hopes that someone would be like, hey, you're vegan. Like, I'm vegan too. Cool. That didn't happen. I ended up meeting up with one of my friends, in the area, but I didn't really see anyone like new that I was like, oh, okay, this person is probably vegan. And of course there were like 10,000 people there. So chances are there were other vegans. And in fact, there was like a vegan-friendly food truck, and there were vegan-friendly places nearby. So it's like there had to be other vegans there, but I don't know. It does kind of stink to be in that culture where it's like it's the things that you love to do, but you know that the people that are also doing it probably have very dissimilar opinions about a lot of very important things to you. So this isn't really an answer. I can totally say that I relate to you. I guess I'm lucky to answer the question, how do I deal with this? I guess I try to find those people that have those interests, like in the nerd community, that also have some other similar interests to me, whether that's like veganism or just into talking about social justice stuff in general. Maybe they're not vegan or vegetarian, but you know, they're not going to make fun of it or something like that. So it's like, if I'm looking for people that I'm, you know, that I'm going to like make connections with and really become close friends with in the nerd community, it's like, I'm really only doing that if they also, you know, have some of these similar views to me, in some of my, the other aspects of my life. So I guess to deal with it, I try to only surround myself with the people that are going to have like a positive impact on me and are going to challenge me and force me to think about new things. Which is tough if you're in the nerd community and that's like, that is your main thing. Cause luckily for me, I like am also kind of in the punk community and I'm more so able to find people in that community that have, that I can connect more with. But I guess just, you know, people, they have to be out there. These nerdy vegans have to be out there. Maybe there's like a nerdy vegan message board or like a subreddit or something like that where we can all meet up. But I don't know. It does kind of stink if that's your main thing, and then it's hard to find other people that are like you. But they have to be out there. So I would encourage you to look for them. Maybe post around on the internet. Nerds love the internet, so we're out there.
Nerds.
I mean, like, look at Andy. Andy does a lot of nerdy stuff. We play board games and stuff all the time.
If anyone out there is listening, likes to play board games, please invite me to your game night.
Or mini golf.
God, yes. I don't know if mini golf is nerdy, but I think how seriously I take it might be considered nerdy.
But yeah, I guess I would just, again, in conclusion, just to conclude my 5-paragraph essay that I just spouted out, just, you know, just try and search out those people, because I think like you were saying, it's like, it's tons of bacon culture and stuff like that. And I don't know, I think I would probably have trouble making like very, very close relationships with someone that I just really, not only did they have a dissimilar view, but we just like really butted heads about stuff. So I probably wouldn't even try and create like a super close friendship out of that, just because I know it's like we're just gonna get into arguments all the time and stuff.
Paul, wouldn't you say though you'll be a more effective advocate if you try to make those relationships happen though?
I suppose. I mean, yeah, you shouldn't like not talk to the person. I guess you kind of have to also think when it's gonna be like, you don't want to burn yourself out if you're being surrounded by a culture that is typically not very accepting of veganism or something like that. But you're right. You know, you do want to still get it out there. And maybe that's what I could kind of hope too when wearing these like vegan shirts and stuff. I was like, maybe I'll start some conversations. I didn't, but but I hoped to.
All right, fair enough. Let's move on to the next question. You want to read this one, Paul?
Sure. This is from Santara Holler, also from Instagram. This may not be the best question for your podcast. No such thing as a bad question. Sorry, that was Paul there. This may not be the best question for your podcast, but what are your thoughts on veganism and feminism? Should they go hand in hand? How can you fight for the equal treatment of women, their reproductive rights, their oppression, etc., and exclude the non-human females? Does it not fall under intersectionality? Question mark. I don't think that's a bad question. I think that's one of the best questions. I feel like that's a very bearded vegan's appropriate question. So I just did a lot of talking, Andy. What are your two cents about this?
I wonder if the not the best question for our podcast comes from the fact that we're two straight men, straight.
Oh,
white,
I got
cis
you.
Men,
I got you,
Paul.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I do think it is a very worthy question, obviously. And so to the first just point of that question, I would agree that perhaps we are not the best people to speak on this topic. With that said, I think when I read this question, it makes me think about people who say you're not a good feminist if you're not also vegan. And so I think, of course, these two topics go hand in hand. They fall under intersectionality, absolutely. But when I see, you know, men within the vegan movement, and I see this from, you know, big figurehead leaders all the way down to, you know, sort of your common civilian vegan, making statements, men making statements to women saying you're not a good feminist if you're not vegan. And I get that essentially it's just sort of trying to get people that care about one issue to realize the connection and the commonality with veganism. But I do think that for us as two men on this podcast to sit here and say that they go hand in hand and that it's like hypocritical to fight for the equal treatment of human women and not non-human women, I feel like that's kind of just tricky territory that I'm not really interested in wading into, even though I do agree that there are plenty of great reasons why if you care about one issue, you should care about the other. And there are a lot of really great pieces written by women that do spell those out a lot better than I could articulate right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I totally misread that first sentence. I thought this person was just asking like, I don't know if this is a good question, but I see where my mistake was now.
How dare you, Paul?
But I think I definitely, yeah, I agree with basically what Andy said, as usual. So now, continuing in our email from Jennifer from the first comment, from the first question. So number two, what do you think about Pokemon Go from a vegan standpoint? I got reamed out on a message board for saying it was just a game that encouraged kids to get outside and build community. And if we as vegans went after it as anti-animal, we would just drive people away from the animal movement without saving a single living, breathing animal.
This is not the first time I've seen someone bring this up. I had a friend who was not vegan sort of questioned vegans who were playing Pokemon Go. And my initial response was, you do realize they're not actually living animals. and the way that I think about it is this, which is, I don't want to kill an animal to eat, you know, a chicken patty. And so I can go and I can get a chicken patty made from vegetables. I can have a vegan chicken patty. And to me, that is like the same thing here where it's like, oh, I don't want to actually hunt down mythical creatures and capture them and then force them to fight each other. But I can do it via this video game. But I do think that it could be a valid concern to say that, you know, it's still something that is affecting the attitudes of the general population in the same way that if you're like to see a movie with something, you know, really misogynistic or something horrible happening to a woman, I don't think it would necessarily be a valid argument to be like, well, that didn't actually happen to her. It's all acting and everyone's paid accordingly. So it doesn't really matter. It's still like a piece of media that we're taking in. So I typical bearded vegan non answer. I can see both points of view. Personally, I feel like there's not a big problem with it from a vegan standpoint. But also when I see people playing like Big Game Hunter or whatever at like an arcade, I'm like, that's kind of messed up. So I don't, and maybe that's just because that's a more realistic thing. That's like a thing people actually go do, whereas Pokemon is just totally in this realm of fantasy. But me personally, I don't think it's that big of a problem. What do you think, Paul?
Well, it's interesting because like I would never play one of those like hunting games. It's like I don't think I feel as anti, like, for instance, Big Game Hunter or something like that. Or if I go and play like Duck Hunter for Nintendo or something like that, I don't feel, I don't know. I don't feel like that's a super non-vegan thing to do, especially because, I mean, it's like every video game that we, not every, I shouldn't say every video game, there are an immense amount of video games that people are playing that are things that if we did them in real life, they would be horrible, horrible things to do. I mean, obviously like Grand Theft Auto is the one that would come to mind, but
Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Or Mortal Kombat. Yeah.
Mario Kart even.
Teaching people how to drive like maniacs.
Side note, Paul and I went to a wrestling event, and one of the wrestlers' move was to throw a banana peel in the ring and cause another wrestler to slip and fall. Very Mario Kart. Very Mario Kart.
Oh, yes. But, yeah, so I don't know. I like, because I play so many video games where it's like I'm doing these horrible, horrible things, and even if it's like, you know, in a medieval setting, I'm still like chopping this dude's head off or something like that, and I don't think that that makes me like a bad vegan. And I wouldn't think that that would make me a bad person because I'm doing that. Now, of course, there are, so it's interesting, and this is not something I've thought a lot about, but there are video games that for me like do cross the line. I forget, there was a game, what was it called? Like Hatred or something like that. That was just like super duper racist and super duper violent. And it's like that stuff I think is crossing the line. But then I guess someone could argue like, well, it's still just a video game and it's not real. So I don't know. I guess for me, there's this line where I'm like, do I really think that this is going to promote the real life version of what you're doing in this video game? And if we go back to Pokemon Go, I 100% do not think that playing Pokemon like is promoting going out and like capturing animals and forcing them to battle or anything like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, I mean, you could definitely make a better argument for those realistic hunting games that something like that is promoting like the hunting culture. But I don't think that someone playing one of those hunting games is going to be the reason why they either hunt or don't hunt.
Yeah, and actually I'm wondering if like the hunting game could be a way to wean a hunter off of hunting.
Yeah, because when you said to me like, oh, if I want a chicken patty, I go get the Gardein chicken patty or something like that, I actually thought where you were going with this conversation was like, and if for some reason I felt compelled to go hunting, I could just go play a hunting video game. I thought that's where you were going with that.
Well, I just went there now, Paul.
But so I don't know. It's like, you know, I think people could 100% totally make an argument that it's still promoting that attitude. And you know, I'm sure there are studies out there and stuff that are, because I'm 100% know that people have done studies on like Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty and stuff, and whether or not it actually promotes people like wanting to do those things. I'm sure those studies are out there, and I guess they could also be applied to something like Big Game Hunter or Pokemon Go. But I think Pokemon Go specifically is so far removed from reality that it's probably okay for vegans to do.
Yeah, and I guess it also just kind of reminds me of, you know, all the craze, like, does violent, you know, rap make people violent? Does video games make people violent? And It's like, I think that it's safe to say that the media we ingest influences our like outlook on the world and how we view things and maybe things that we think are cool or not. But if, you know, a certain type of music or a certain band or something like made people violent, then a lot more people would be violent because of it, not just sort of like a few outliers. So I think that there's not really anything to conclusively say that these things lead to, you know, people going exploiting animals. And I guess we didn't really talk about the second half of this question, Paul, which is that it would drive people away from veganism if they made a big stink about Pokemon Go. I think I believe that. I think that that's something that people will look at and go, that's ridiculous. It's a video game. So, yeah. I mean, I think it's all well and good to sort of talk about in our little vegan bubble here, but I think I have to agree that it doesn't seem like it's enough of an issue to warrant taking up space in a non-vegan world. And it's really just going to make people go, oh, vegans are pretty ridiculous. They won't even play Pokemon Go, which is this incredibly popular game that is having a lot of positive, you know, benefits for people in terms of exercise and community building and all those things.
But of course, like, if you don't want to play Pokemon Go, like, we are not saying that you should go out and play Pokemon Go. Like, if you're like, this seems like a little too, because, you know, I think some people don't like playing certain types of video games because they're like, oh man, this is like really violent and really realistic. And of course, if you don't want to play a video game, like, don't, you know, don't play it.
Actually, I think you're a bad vegan if you don't play Pokemon Go.
And go out and eat the Impossible Burger.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think anyone should give someone else a hard time for enjoying Pokemon Go. But I think it's totally a valid viewpoint for you personally, you know, to say, you know, I'm not down with what this game is trying to do. But I think as far as taking minutes away from our activist time, even if it's just a few minutes of posting on Facebook, there's a lot more, a lot better ways that you could be advocating for animals. Because as Jennifer points out, that there's no living animals involved with this, so you're really not saving any animals except for, you know, whatever potential slight influence on public consciousness that this thing is adding. But again, they're so far removed that they might as well be dragons and unicorns or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Didn't expect such a lengthy conversation off that one. All right, Paul, this is another one for you.
All right.
Popular Paul.
Popular Paul.
You become a professor and look what happens. All right. Paul, how do you handle grocery shopping with your Omni partner? I was picking up lunch yesterday for my husband and myself. I like this kebab place we have in town and got my wrap with veggies and hummus. I knew he would order the chicken for himself if he was staying there with me, but I couldn't do it. So I got the identical wrap to mine. He ate it and said nothing. Am I forcing him to be vegan? Does this sort of thing fall under, quote, don't try to convert your partner? I just can't really buy meat at all anymore, even if I know that someone I love would prefer meat and buy it if they were there. I only fix vegan food at home since these wraps are coming home and I was buying them. That's what I decided needed to happen. Who knows? I don't know. So props for using our catchphrase that has never caught on and no one realizes our catchphrase, but who knows? I don't know.
Oh, God.
So there's a lot, Paul, there's a lot of questions in here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, so to the first question, do you think this act of purchasing vegan food for the partner when they would probably otherwise prefer chicken instead of the vegetables, is that forcing their partner to be vegan?
I think definitely not. I'm being definitive on this one. I don't think so. I think, like, you know, I think you can have a very respectful and polite conversation with your partner and be like, hey, you know, it's like, I'm not going to tell you what you have to do, but just to let you know, like, I'm not really comfortable buying meat anymore. So it's like, you know, please don't put me in that situation. And just know that, like, if there is that kind of situation that comes up, like, I'm probably not going to buy meat. And I think that's all you have to say. And, you know, if you're in like a nice communicative relationship with someone else, hopefully the other person will respond positively and be like, yeah, that's cool. And again, it's like, I would hope that someone, you know, if this only happens once every blue moon, is not going to be like, I need my ham and cheese, and is going to throw some tantrum about not getting something for like one time. And it's like, in obviously in the limited amount of details that you gave, you know, it didn't seem like he was bothered by it, which, you know, again, not having that one time and knowing who it's coming from is probably like, okay, she probably just didn't feel like buying me meat. But if you're concerned that like you feel like you're forcing him, or maybe you're concerned that he's going to think that you're trying to force him. Like I said, I think if you just kind of have that easy few sentence conversation, just be like, you know what? I don't really feel comfortable buying meat. Sorry, I didn't get you your chicken wrap yesterday. I think you know how I feel about these things. So yeah, like I think you can be polite and respectful and in that, and I would think that he would be able to respect that. I don't have that much experience in terms of grocery shopping, because the only partner that I've lived with in the past has also been vegan. So grocery shopping was not really an issue. That's not something I can really insert my expertise about. What were the other questions? Who knows? I don't know.
I guess it was all just kind of one thing, that a bunch of questions that all kind of melded into one. Paula, I agree with you. I think that it is totally fine. And this is sort of like the policy that I have, which is I won't buy non-vegan food or a non-vegan thing for anybody, even if they're paying me back, even if, you know, whatever the circumstances. So I think it's totally fine that you sort of set that ground rule. And, you know, it seems like those are already commonplace, like you only make vegan food at home, things like that. And I think that that's important for the partner to respect. And I've done this where I've, like, you know, been out with friends. I'm like, I would love to, you know, treat you to this meal, but I can only do it, you know, I'll pay for you, but only if you order vegan food. And I think that that's a totally reasonable thing, because why would you want to financially support someone or like an industry that you don't believe in or have ethical problems with, you know? So I think that's totally reasonable.
Yeah, I do think it's, I don't know. I think I have a slightly differing opinion than Andy about it. But we don't have to get into that now.
Well, wait. What do you mean by that, Paul?
What's that?
What do you mean?
I don't know. I feel like there are, for me personally, it's like, someone that I've been dating, so I'm not currently dating anyone at the moment, but
attention, ladies.
But my past two relationships have been with omnivores, and I don't know. I for me, it's like there have been times when I've never bought meat before, but I've definitely put in money for like dairy products or something like that. And it's not something that I like to do, but I don't know. I don't know. I'm a terrible vegan, Andy. That's what I'm trying to admit.
This is what I have to say about that, Paul. I don't think that makes you a terrible vegan, but I think that if someone does have that stance, if they are saying, I will refuse to pay any money towards any animal product, I don't think that someone should feel like that makes them a bad vegan or that they're not being supportive of their partner. I think that that's an important ethical stance. And I also think that perhaps, you know, a partner should, I guess everyone has different, you know, levels of veganism, whatever. I think the partner should also respect who, you know, the vegan, to not ask them to pay for something that they know is against their ethics.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I'm trying to get at, and I don't think you'll disagree with this. I feel like for me, at least, it seems hard to make a real blanket statement, because, you know, it's like in every different relationship, you're going to be like, you need a different amount of, like, you provide different amounts of supports, or you need different support. And I feel like you kind of just have to play it case by case, I guess.
Yeah.
Did that make any sense?
I mean, I agree. I guess I just think that it is a totally valid stance to say, I refuse to pay for any animal products, and that your partner should respect that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Andy, I'm going to come over there and beat you up. Yeah, no.
That would mean you actually have to visit me for once.
You're right. No. That I totally agree with that. Yeah, totally agree with that. I'm just trying to make, I think I'm trying to make other people that maybe do the same thing as me feel not like bad vegans, and I'm just doing this because I don't want to feel like a bad vegan.
Well, I don't think that anyone that does it should feel like a bad vegan, but I understand that situation, that can be like a weird situation, especially if you're dating people that aren't vegan, especially like early on and when kind of, things haven't really been established so much. But yeah. I think that people should feel comfortable making a stand and saying that they refuse to purchase animal products regardless of the situation.
Yes. I agree.
All right. Okay. Now that we've agreed, we may move on. This is a question I don't really have an answer to, Paul. So I'm going to ask you this question.
All right.
See what you think.
I think I have an answer to this one.
Okay. This comes from Jackson, and this is a comment left appropriately on thecommentist.com. So that's, we plug it every week, but the comment, so it's like thecommentist.com. That is our podcast network. Every episode has its own individual page to comment on, so we always mind these, we read everything even if we don't respond to everything, so this is always a great place for us to go and get people's thoughts on specific episodes. So anyway, from Jackson, here's a question for your next mailbag episode, and here it is. What do you think of humans trying to quote unquote protect certain species from extinction due to predation by invasive species? What duty do we have, if any, to preserve biodiversity, even if it means killing sentient predators? Should we just step back and say, good for the lionfish? Paul, I have no education or knowledge on this topic, and I have not really thought about it. What do you think?
So when I looked at this, I can tell you what my initial thoughts are, and I think they're pretty good. So you could feel free, Andy, to tell me why I'm completely wrong.
You got good thoughts, Paul.
Thank you.
I like your thoughts.
I think good thoughts. So I would say I think that we should not protect certain species from extinction due to like invasive species. I think that, like, it's my kind of personal philosophy, is to just kind of like let nature do nature. And of course, if you're like, if you see like a wounded animal or something, I think you could help out that specific animal. But I think when we try to apply that to like an entire species, I think humanity has a pretty good record at mucking things up for the world. And I don't really see how us, kind of like trying to monitor one population so that it doesn't invade another population, and then it's then messing up some other population and like the ecosystem is all ruined. I don't know. One, I feel like we would just kind of mess that up. But then the bigger part for me was like, well, do we want these species to not go extinct for the species sake, or do we just want these species to not go extinct so that they're here on Earth for us to enjoy them? And I almost feel like it's more so we would be doing it for the second reason, because it's like the animal, like once they go extinct, they're not gonna know that they're extinct because they're not gonna exist at all. But it's really, we're like, oh, that's a shame that they went extinct. But really, it's a shame for us because they're not here for us to enjoy them. So I think for that reason, I'm kind of like, I think that we should just like let nature happen. And if a species is naturally going to go extinct, then like I don't think that we should like mess with that.
So Paul, you keep using the word naturally. Now, what if the increase in the invasive species is because of something that mankind has done? They've been removing sharks from the water, and that allows the lionfish to thrive. I have no idea if that's actually what the case is, but yeah. But it seems like in a lot of situations of invasive species, it's because of something that humans are doing that has allowed one species to kind of take over.
Yeah.
In that situation, do you think that we should step in to correct course?
I think that would have to be done on like a case by case basis, because
This is the case.
Because it's like, Because I feel like what we would end up doing is we would try to correct it, and then it would just be like, you know, we're modifying. We just keep modifying things because we keep messing up the last thing that we modified. And so then we have to make some correction to that, and then making that correction messes up something else. And I feel like it's this big chain. Like, I think if you can get it, if there's like one thing that you can do, you're like, okay, we just need to do this one thing, and it's going to get it back to how it was before. Like, maybe I'd be more open to that, but not if it was like, you know, oh, we just need to kill these 30,000 fish, these 30,000 fish, and then they won't invade this other species of fish, so then we'll be good. Like, I wouldn't be comfortable with that, period.
Yeah, I just don't know. I think I generally agree that, like, we should step back and not mess with nature as much as possible. But I think maybe that's like an impossible position to hold because we are so thoroughly messing up nature on our own accord anyway. So
yeah, that's true.
So I don't really have an answer. So I guess what Paul said will have to suffice.
Yeah, you're right though, because when I was thinking of it, when I thought I had a good answer, it was more so like it kind of relies on the fact that there are still parts of nature that we don't have our grimy hands all over, and those parts of the world are few and far between. So I guess we kind of already have messed with most of it, and we've kind of gotten to this place. So I still think you kind of want to look at it on a case-by-case basis, though, and then say, like, okay, am I going to do something that's then going to make this species continue to be reliant on something that we have to do? Or is there some fix that you can do that's then like, okay, now these foxes are all good. Like, they're all set. We don't have to keep doing something. We just like adjusted something about them, and now they're all set. Like, that I think would be more acceptable than like, okay, now we're putting these foxes like in this closed like section of the forest, and we're going to monitor and make sure they only stay there, and like, they're not allowed to leave there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. This question kind of reminds me of some articles I've seen popping up that are kind of suggesting that if we are concerned with saving the most amount of animals, then that means that we do need to kill predator animals, because like killing this one predator animal will save, you know, however many of their prey animals are.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to touch that in a full episode, but yeah, it to me, it feels like hands off is the best way to go, but there's no such thing as hands off anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that depressing note, let's move on to the next question. So this next question is from Emily, and this was also posted on thecommentist.com. Thank you, Emily. What do you think about animal rescues and shelters? I recently started volunteering at a horse rescue that rehabilitates horses who were seized by animal control, which was something of a difficult decision for me because I really like being around horses and want to help animals, but I don't condone horseback riding or similar exploitation of horses by humans. I think that it is a good thing that the organization is nursing horses back to physical health, which is something that I wanted to be a part of, thus why I decided to volunteer there. But I have problems with the degrees of emphasis that they place on training the horses to be ridden. Like, a horse has no worth if they're not able to be trained for riding. I wish people would just see their worth as a living animal without needing to make them serve some purpose for human use. On the plus side, the rescue does seem to really care about each of the horses there. It is clear they don't mentally connect riding with exploitation, though. What do you think, Andy?
Okay, so the question is, what do you think about animal rescues and shelters? And then all of this story is given. So I think, in general, I think animal rescues and shelters are great because it's a way for us as humans to, you know, course correct for wrongs that are being done by other human beings. In this situation, I'm not sure how I feel. I guess it's better for these horses to sort of be rehabbed, and then I don't know. I don't know if it's better. I think it's good that they're getting cared for, but if they're then just being sent out to be exploited via horseback riding, then is that really worth doing? It kind of reminds me of there are animals, farmed animal sanctuaries out there that I've visited that I've loved. They've had a great, clear message. They'll have little like billboards up around the sanctuary explaining, you know, why people should go vegan. And then I've been to some that just kind of feel a little bit too much like a petting zoo. And mm-hmm. and those are the ones that I don't return to. Those are the ones that I don't donate to. And this almost feels like that latter situation where I'm like, okay, I'm glad that, you know, a facility exists, because otherwise these animals would be dead. But I don't love that they're kind of, you know, more or less using these animals to turn a profit, even if it's just to keep the facility open. It just feels icky to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I can, like, I don't know if I can quantify what's better or worse. I mean, it's probably the best thing for any living being on this planet is just to be dead, so you don't have to deal with this horrible reality that we live
in. Very depressing, Andrew.
But short of that, I don't really know if I can weigh those two things out. But it almost is like indentured servitude, you know, like you save someone's life and then you're like, okay, now you have to work for me for the rest of your life. You know,
yeah,
to me, it kind of feels like that.
Yeah.
And I guess I just gotta say, I don't think that's cool.
No, I definitely agree. I'm in the exact same boat as you are. It's, you know, it's like tough. And then I agree with Andy, but then in terms of like, if I would volunteer at a place like this, because, you know, it's like Andy was saying, it's like you're helping out the animal, but then with the kind of underlying like theme that you're going to send it back into whatever it was doing before. So it's
Paul, please refer to animals as they and not it.
I'm sorry. My bad. but yeah. Yeah.
So do you think that Emily should not work there at all?
Well, she's volunteering, so she's not working.
It's work. unpaid internship.
I don't know. That's tough. Because, you know, it's like she's still doing something good for the animals, right? It's like she's still helping them out. And I think it's tough because a facility like this, I wouldn't necessarily say it's like a pure good thing, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's a pure bad thing. I think it's like somewhere in the middle, like those, like the animal sanctuaries that you were talking about, where they feel more like petting zoos. I would quantify that as kind of a similar thing, where it's like, well, it's like they're doing good stuff, but at the same time, like you said, the whole feel of it is like not very good. It's not, doesn't seem like a very they have a very vegan attitude about it. So I don't know. I think that's just something that Emily can kind of weigh the pros and cons of, and maybe kind of think about how you feel about it. Think about what you want for the horses, and really if they're getting through this facility that you're volunteering at, if they're getting what you want them to get. And I mean, but of course, maybe this is the only opportunity that you have to do this sort of thing. That's, I would guess that's maybe the case. And that makes your decision even harder, obviously, because like you said, you want to help them out. You want to be around them. But if you can't condone some of the stuff that they're doing, I guess you just kind of have to weigh it out in your head. Period.
Basically, we're saying you can answer your own question.
Sorry, Emily.
Yeah, that's tricky. I mean, it kind of makes me think about how, you know, people will say work at a place that's not vegan, which for the vast majority of vegans, that's kind of what their working opportunities are going to be. And we wouldn't necessarily, you know, cast judgment on someone for working, someone doing what they need to do to get by. We sort of live in a non-vegan world, and that means that we have these imperfect things. And so even though this is volunteering, it's not something that you're making money off of, Emily, it does still kind of feel like there's so many worse things you could be doing with your time that, mm-hmm. you know, this is a way to help animals that I wouldn't feel horrible about it. If this is something that you do feel compelled to keep doing, and maybe there are ways to kind of change things from the inside, though. I wonder if this is not apparent in the question. is this rescue able to stay open because they are then providing horseback giving horseback lessons or selling the horses? Like, I wonder how it functions, and like if that aspect of the horse's exploitation is like a necessary part of keeping the sanctuary open, at least in the eyes of the people that are running it. Because obviously there are plenty of farmed animal sanctuaries that don't necessitate the exploitation of the animals in order to stay open.
Yeah.
It's a tricky one, Emily.
It is.
Got us stumped. All right. So this email comes from Stacy, who I met at the Arizona Veg Food Festival earlier this year.
Hi, Stacy.
Hello, Stacy. Stacy totally hooked it up when I went to Green, and I got some of those vegan crab puffs that are amazing. So thanks, Stacy. Anyway, hi, Beardos. Hello, Stacy. I have been contemplating something recently. Activism. Do you think every vegan, specifically ethical vegan, should participate in some form of activism at least once? Whether it be leafleting, pay-per-view, is posting and commenting on social media a form of activism? Is simply being vegan a form of activism? I know we agree on what forms of activism are most effective, so no need to touch on that. Smiley face. Ever since I've been vegan, I've also been an activist slash advocate. It has cemented my veganism, helped me stay informed on what's happening in the movement, new documentaries, articles, groups, etc., because I want to be able to share the most relevant information with people. I like having those one-on-one conversations with people. Makes me feel like I'm doing more for the animals and being a more effective vegan. It also has made conversations with my family and friends so much easier because I'm versed on information and have dealt with receptive and non-receptive people. Since I have covered many aspects of a vegan lifestyle with strangers, I'm less apprehensive to talk to a family member and usually have an answer for all of their questions. Therefore, I feel it would be useful for those that identify as ethical vegans. Curious on how you feel about that. So, Paul, let's start at the top there.
All right.
Do you think every vegan, specifically ethical vegan, should participate in some form of activism?
I think yes. And the reason I think yes is because I would say, you know, I feel like if you feel passionate about anything, especially in this kind of social justice circle, so anything that falls under that category, it's like I would promote people to kind of advocate for that. I think that this is how we kind of make, you know, this is how we make change in the world, is by advocating and for these different movements. Now, I think that what form that's going to take is going to be very different for different people. And even though I think, like Stacy said, like we can talk about which forms we think are the most effective, you know, it's still different people are going to be stronger at different forms of advocacy. So like maybe for some person, you know, like posting and commenting on social media stuff is the only thing that they really feel comfortable doing. And I don't think that that's necessarily like a bad thing. I don't think that we should be like, oh, you should be out there. Like you should be out there leafleting or something like that. If the most that they can do is just like posting stuff online. So, while I do think that I do think that people have to do it. I think I would suggest that people participate in some form of activism because you know, I think if this is what you believe in, I think this is how we kind of change the world. So that's how I would answer that first part.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you. I think that it is highly encouraged for any vegan to engage in vegan activism, and also agree with you, Paul, that that is going to be a different form for different people. And for some people, that is starting a vegan bakery, or, you know, making a documentary, or even just someone that's sort of there to kind of comment on things online, write letters to the editor. I think the best advice as far as like veganism and activism and influencing, you know, other people, the general public, is to find the thing that you like to do, because that'll be sustainable, hopefully, and then figure out how you can apply veganism to that thing. You know, so some people, maybe you'll start like a clothing line, who knows? But, you know, yeah, like you said, not everyone's gonna be sued for anything. I think caveat is that there is a lot of ableism in people who sort of just sit there and rail against armchair activists, and all you do is post online. You need to be out there marching in the streets and maybe yelling at someone or holding a sign or like whatever it is. Those, you know, people who sort of view activism as one type of thing and then shame others for not engaging in it. You know, there's a lot of people who physically can't do that stuff. And I also think that, you know, like you were just saying, Paul, different people are good at different things. So just because someone's not willing to engage in your preferred form of activism doesn't necessarily mean that they're not being an activist. Mm-hmm. But I think that, yeah, we would both heavily encourage people to get out there and engage in some kind of activism, even if it doesn't mean getting out there, if it just means sitting in your armchair there.
And you know, it's like, I feel like with veganism, it's almost brought upon you because when people find out that you are vegan, they will often engage you in conversations about it, whether they're trying to be antagonistic or actually genuinely curious. I feel like that these kind of conversations get brought upon us oftentimes when someone finds out you're vegan. And, you know, like that, those are like good opportunities, you know, rather than dismissing it. If you're able to, rather than just being like, oh, I don't want to talk about it, you know, like try and have a meaningful, positive conversation with that person.
Definitely. And there is one group out there who maintains that veganism is not the moral baseline, but activism is the moral baseline. And so to that question, Paul, do you think just simply being vegan is a form of activism or is enough?
I think being vegan is like what we want to do, is what we want to be, and then that the activism is how we are going to get other people to be like that. So I don't know. I don't want this to turn into some like argument about semantics, but I feel like since veganism is actually what we want to be, that's fine. You know, it's like I wouldn't, even though like I was just saying, it's like I would encourage people to participate in some form of activism. I don't necessarily think that they are like bad people or bad vegans if they don't. You know, it's like if my goal is to get the entire world to be vegan, I don't think even if that starts to happen, I still don't think every single one of these people, every single person that becomes vegan is also going to be promoting veganism. I don't think that necessarily needs to happen if we are going to create like massive social change. We obviously need to have a lot of people, but I don't think necessarily everyone needs to do it. So I don't think I would agree that like, I don't think I would agree with that statement that it's like veganism isn't the moral baseline that activism is. I disagree. I firmly disagree.
I like it, a solid answer on the podcast. Yeah, and I guess I think it's really cool when there's like someone that's sort of out there doing their thing in the world and they're doing something really awesome. They're an artist or whatever it might be. They're a cool accountant, who knows? And then you just sort of like find out that they're vegan at some point and they don't make it like a central part of their activism. And I do think for some people, that's what's going to be that speaks to them, because a lot of people, I think I've heard from people, they're worried that going vegan means you have to go march in the streets and be angry about everything and throw red paint on people. And you know, and that's kind of why we have like the loud, angry vegan stereotype. And that's because the people that speak out about it are the ones that are going to get noticed. It's not going to be the person that really kind of keeps it to themselves, unfortunately. But yeah, I don't think that someone is a bad vegan if they don't engage in some form of activism. And I guess we can just define that as any attempt, any activity that one takes in order to help change the world for animals. So, you know, I'm not interested in shaming someone that doesn't do that, but I think it's an important thing because obviously that's what's going to accelerate the rate of social change, is more people doing more things. And, you know, there's a lot of worthy causes out there that need bodies to, you know, volunteer, donate, show up and do the work. So I do think it's an important thing to do, but I don't think it's the only thing to do. And I think for those who are unable to do it, that no one should feel bad for being unable to do it.
Yeah, and I think you started touching upon a couple important things that I want to highlight, which is that, you know, there are so many social movements out there that are amazing. And as we've talked about before, it's like you're probably not going to be able to be putting all of your effort into all of these different things. So like maybe veganism isn't the movement that you excel at advocating for. Maybe it's a different movement that you're very, very passionate about. And again, like Annie was saying, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't be vegan. It's like you can be vegan while you're doing all this other great stuff. And I don't necessarily think that you not like being out there advocating for veganism on the streets means that you're like a bad vegan.
All right. So that's good. I think, and I guess just to address the sort of the second half of Stacey's email there is a lot of benefit to be gained from activism, even more than just sort of helping the animals directly, is that you sort of enrich yourself as an activist. And I agree, like doing the 10 billion lives tour and having all these conversations, that made me more well equipped to have conversations with people. Obviously, you know, practice makes perfect. Mm-hmm. The more you do it, the better you get. So if you, and you know, we would have a lot of people come to volunteer and, you know, they would watch me and whoever I was on tour with, I was on tour with a couple of people, and they would say, wow, like you have these like in-depth engaging conversations with people and I can barely get them to talk to me for 30 seconds. And, you know, so it's like the more you do it, the better you do get. So I think that there's a lot of benefits to going out and engaging in some type of activism. And by going out could even mean just getting online and talking to people. So I agree. And again, I guess that's a long way of saying, again, you should do it if you feel compelled to do it. And if you're feeling apprehensive about it, know that it's not going to be a bad experience. You know, you just sort of have to, if you feel like you want to, but there's something holding you back, I would encourage people to sort of just push themselves to do it, get a little outside of their comfort zone. And once you do it, you'll realize that it's a lot easier to do and than you were expecting it to be.
Yeah. Nice little wrap up there, Andy.
All right. Let's leave that question there. Thank you, Stacy, for writing in again.
Cool. So I think, is this our last email, Andy?
This is the final email. It's been a long journey thus far, Paul.
So this is an email from Annie, and it reads, y'all recently mentioned in your news segment that the government is purchasing $20 million worth of cheese that it plans to distribute to food banks in an effort to help out the dairy industry. In an article I read from Business Insider, it was stated that the government consistently buys smaller amounts of cheese for its programs and has done these sorts of special large-scale buys in the past, so the support for dairy farmers is not unprecedented. Recently, there was also news that the dairy industry implemented what they call a herd retirement program, which resulted in the killing of 500,000 dairy cows, allegedly in an effort to drive up dairy prices. Given these two examples of the way government and corporations work in a capitalistic market, do you think that focusing our attention on the consumer for vegan advocacy is worth our efforts? And does this mean that all of the memes bragging that being vegan saves however many animals each year is actually a flat-out lie? Lastly, if we are just simply living the vegan lifestyle by not consuming animal products, but are not actively trying to change hearts and minds and challenge speciesism, laws, and capitalism, is that enough? So that last part kind of is similar to the last question we asked.
Yeah.
Good tie-in.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Annie, for the email.
Yeah.
And Annie also very helpfully provided links and quotes, so we will include those links in our show notes as well. This is a big one. We started to kind of touch on this when we were talking about this news item, at least the cheese purchase. And I think we both kind of, it feels very defeating and deflating to feel like we're doing this work and we're making progress. And then the government's just like, actually, we're going to bail them out and we're going to do this. And you know, they're going to counteract the work of thousands of vegans just with one single, you know, signing of a document that allows this kind of bailout to happen. So I definitely can relate to just kind of feeling like, is this enough? Like, what can we possibly do? Like, is it going to be a situation where no matter how many vegans we make, the government is just going to keep bailing out these industries or keep, you know, supplementing them, funding them, giving them tax breaks, whatever it might be, in a way that just sort of keeps this industry going?
I do think that we are still making a difference. And the reason that I think this is because, like, as we can create more vegans, and as these issues are exposed, because I think maybe one of the big things about this whole cheese debacle is that maybe, like, a lot of people might not just might not know about it. Like, before we talked about it on the show, I didn't know about it. And I feel like it's the type of thing that people, you know, would be angry about if they knew about it. And even I feel like some non-vegans, because it's just like an absurd amount of money that's being spent on a product that, you know, is shown to be like not wanted anymore, or not as wanted anymore. So it's like, I feel like people would be angry about that just because it's spending so much money. But regardless, I think it's okay that we are advocating, you know, to just creating new vegans, because if we can create enough vegans, you know, like, eventually us vegans are going to put enough of a stink that the government would have to listen to some extent. But then even beyond that, the more vegans we create, the more likely we're going to have vegans within the government, and then we can start dismantling them from the inside. Cory Booker for president.
That's very SLC punk of you, Paul.
I feel like it's okay that, I mean, we do need to, you know, we do need to look at laws. We do need to look at government. And, you know, we just reviewed, when did we release the movie review episode already, right? Or is that next episode?
That's next week.
So next episode, here's a little spoiler alert that we already recorded. In the movie that we're reviewing, it's all about, you know, laws and stuff like that. And that's something that we discuss. It's like, it's not something that as a day-to-day vegan conversations, we're not really talking about, like, oh, these laws need to be changed, blah, blah, blah. But that is maybe something that the vegans that are capable of doing these things, the ones that have a much higher degree than myself, that are like lawyers and stuff, will be able to make these changes. So again, I think that as we create more vegans, we're going to see more vegans in these different positions, and they'll be able to hit, like, they'll be able to take at, like the government, and they'll be able to work with, like, the laws and stuff like that, and help out in those ways.
Paul, don't sell yourself short. You're an adjunct professor. That's like, thanks, like, two steps below a lawyer.
Basically.
Yeah. I think that we absolutely should not discount avenues other than making new vegans. For me personally, just within my ability and my observations on activism and whatnot, I do still, for me, I think that making new vegans is my number one priority, and also retaining vegans, I guess, would be a close second. But I think that we should absolutely be supporting legislative efforts to change things. I think that we mentioned this on some podcast in the last 50 years, Paul, about you know, what if the subsidies that were going to meat and dairy were going to, you know, produce instead, and how that would affect things. And, you know, Paul, you and I are not experts on anything, except you know a lot about math. But it seems like, you know, efforts to do things like that would vastly alter what is affordable in this country, what is focused on by various industries in terms of marketing and selling. And so I think that we kind of need all of it. We need everything. And so I'm always wary of anyone that says, like, well, this is the one most effective type of activism, you know, in terms of making new vegans. Maybe there's not one specific way to do it, but also it's like, we need all these avenues. I do believe we need people working at a legislative level. I do believe we need people that are working from, like, a direct action level. You know, there's, like, so many different things that we need that are going to be necessary to sort of get the change that we want, that we shouldn't count any of them out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think when I think about veganism, you sort of have to push the notion in your head back that it's all kind of futile and you're not doing anything and nothing's going to change and change is so slow and you're making such a small dent. You're making basically an insignificant dent as a human being and in the problem and the number of animals that are being killed. And, you know, I'll have these moments where I was like, what am I doing? Like, how do I do anything? And just, you know, for a matter of surviving as a human being and not being crushed by the weight of it all, it's like I just sort of have to keep my head down and keep making new vegans, keep putting out content that's hopefully going to help support, you know, vegans and retain vegans. And you know I think that in some level that's all a lot of us can do. So I don't know. And then I also question, okay, well, if we're really trying to make change, does that mean trying to figure out how to abolish capitalism? Or, you know, like, what is it that is making this task so monumentally hard for us to do? And so many of them just seem so overwhelmingly, you know, weighty to take on that it feels like keeping your head down and doing these smaller tasks is the only way to really get by.
Mm. Dang, Andy, that was deep.
Thanks, Paul.
No, that was good though. That was much more eloquent than anything that I've probably ever said in my entire life.
No, oh, Paul. But, you made that great took a poll in Ibiza joke for the next episode.
Oh boy. What is life?
Baby, don't hurt me. outro music. Okay. Paul, do you have anything else to add?
I don't think so. I agree with what you're saying. We got to kind of try to keep some sort of optimism in this bleak, bleak world. Mm. Delightfully jaded, Andy, as usual.
Yep. And then I guess the one thing that we did not address in Annie's email here, just the question, does this mean that all the memes bragging that vegans saves however many animals each year is actually a flat out lie?
I usually don't post those because I don't think that there's really any way to, I don't think there's any realistic way to figure out how many animals like one person has saved. I think maybe if you measured how many animal products you ate in one entire year and then stopped eating that, maybe that would help out a little bit, but
I think that's exactly how they measure it, Paul.
So I don't shame people for posting them. I just don't post to myself.
Yeah. I think that there's sort of an issue of semantics here. I don't think that being vegan necessarily saves an animal's life. To me, saving is like removing an animal from a place of abuse.
Yeah.
I think that we're sparing animals, which to me is hopefully preventing them from being entered into the supply chain, you know, the whole supply and demand aspect of it. So, yeah, I do think that those memes and those statistics, they're a little more nuanced than they make it out to be. It's not like one person decides to go vegan and then like the meat and dairy industry is like, okay, pull a quarter of a cow off the production line and 30 chickens and 2 pigs, you know, whatever the exact breakdown is. But it is in the numbers, like every 1,000 vegans that do that, it does, you know, have that impact. So it's like you have a 1 out of 1,000 chance of being the person that causes all these animals to be saved. So maybe that's bleak, or maybe that's really like, oh, that's cool. Like I could be the person that saves XYZ number of animals. I think that the memes are simplistic, but I also can see the purpose they serve because we do want to feel like we're having an impact. Mm-hmm. I do agree that if it's like a meme that's kind of like bragging about the whole thing, that's not likely to go over well, but I understand the purpose of them, and I don't think that I haven't posted one in years, but I don't think that they're like blanketedly bad to use necessarily.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's good to feel good about what you're doing, because that's going to, because even though we're not doing it for ourselves, if you're feeling good about what you're doing, you're probably going to do it more, and you're probably going to be able to keep doing it. So I think that's maybe why people post them. But like you said, where it could get rough is if it's a meme that's like, then, you know, it has some, like you said, some sort of bragging thing or some sort of like attacking type tone, because then it's just going to start arguments with meaties and probably not going to lead to a productive discussion. Maybe it will. So prove me wrong. But from what I've seen, it's typically either people are violently people on the on those that are commenting on like a picture like that are either going to be aggressively for it or aggressively against it, and then there's not too much nonviolent communication to be had. Andy,
no, I think the biggest takeaway from your answer right there, Paul,
yes,
was when you said it's good to feel good.
It's good to feel good.
It's good to feel good. True statement.
And then I should have just shut my yapper after that.
All right. Well, I think it's probably good for us to leave it off there. Again, thank you to everyone that has written in, email, Instagram, the commentist. We read everything. We try and respond to everything. Obviously, we don't get to everything in a timely fashion, but we wither and die without your attention. So please keep the emails coming. We really do appreciate it. We like to know that people are listening beyond whatever numbers iTunes gives us. So thank you very much. And also, we haven't asked this in a while, but if you like what we do, please be sure to leave us a review and a rate on iTunes. That helps us get higher up in the rankings. If you like what we have to say, you like how we talk about veganism, look at the world of veganism, go ahead and do that. It helps us out immensely.
Thank you. Thank you for all those who have already done it.
Yes. And for those who missed it somehow at the top of the show, the email is thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. The
Instagram, couldn't imagine how they missed it, Andy.
Well, you know, Paul, it happens. The Instagram is thebeardvegans, and the website is thecommentist.com. That's thecommentist.com.
So, what do you have coming up, Andy?
Oh, this weekend, I've been looking forward to it for a while. The DC Veg Fest on September 24th. That is obviously in Washington, D.C.
And obviously this weekend.
Yes. And October 15th and 16th, I'll be at the Triangle Veg Fest in Raleigh, North Carolina. October 22nd and 23rd, Compassion Company will be at the Boston Veg Fest in Boston, Massachusetts with Paul's surrogate, Josh. And then October 22nd, I will be at the Central Florida Veg Fest in Orlando, Florida. So come on down. I'll be behind the Compassion Company table. You can get all the details, dates, deeds, and links at CompassionCo.com. And that's all that I have to say, Paul. What do you have to say?
We are the Bearded Vegan, signing off.
And you could be that thousandth. How do you? You're the math teacher, Paul.
Thousandth?
Thousandth? I can't do it.
Thousandth? There we go. Thousandth.
Yes.
Thousandth.